Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast reviewing the clinic didactics put together for the Virginia Mason Internal Medicine Residency Program. I'm Madhani Mohanachandran, and I'm joined today by Dr. Anesh Shenoy.
Good morning.
And today we will be covering alcohol use disorder and related conditions, with much credit to Dr. Joy Boucher, Dr. Lindsay Warner, and then also to Dr. Sarita Soares, who had written the didactic for the Yale curriculum. All right. Well, Dr. Shenoy, what are main goals today?
Oh, excellent question, Dr. Mohan. So we're going to try to review a couple different concepts around alcohol use disorder. And my goals for everyone are to, first of all, utilize evidence-based screening strategies to help identify patients who are at risk for unhealthy alcohol use. And then to feel more comfortable about implementing brief interventions and to use motivational interviewing techniques. Third learning goal for everybody is to be more comfortable with pharmacologic therapies for patients with alcohol use disorders. And also fourth, kind of a sub-point about being able to recognize and potentially treat comorbid psychiatric and behavioral health diseases that go along with substance use disorders, as well as other substance use disorders, even though that's its whole other multiple other talks. Why don't I also give a little bit of background about why this is so important? So hopefully this is not a surprise to any of our listeners, but alcohol use is very common, and it is used by more people in the United States than tobacco, than electronic nicotine delivery systems, or street or illicit drugs. Many health conditions, including cancer, cardiovascular disease, and liver disease are associated with excessive alcohol use and alcohol use disorder. And I cannot tell you how often my patients are surprised that alcohol does more than just hurt their liver. Nearly 30 million people in the United States reported in the past year alcohol use disorders. But despite its incredible prevalence, alcohol use disorder is very undertreated. And I think we can make a strong case that primary care is the optimal setting to screen and treat alcohol use disorders. Also, as usual, we have our health equity spotlight. So if it's okay, Dr. Mohan, I will keep going.
Yes, please.
All right. So women are more vulnerable to the harms associated with alcohol use than men. More rapid progression to alcohol use disorder and alcohol-associated liver disease. Also, although per capita consumption rates tend to be higher in people from higher socioeconomic strata, most harms associated with alcohol use are higher among those from lower socioeconomic groups. And the reasons for this, they're quite a few, but consumption patterns can be different, but probably access to care and association with other risk factors tend to correlate more with lower socioeconomic status, like smoking, obesity, decreased physical activity, and kind of differences in job settings and just overall access to resources. Another key point are that people from groups that have historically been marginalized on the basis of race, ethnicity, and sexuality may experience more alcohol-associated harms and greater barriers to receiving kind of indicated and appropriate alcohol-related care. And then I think the last point that I want to stress is that the available treatment services varies considerably on the basis of geography, with the greatest gaps in rural settings. So I'm also going to give a couple of take-home points for those who are really short on time. Unhealthy alcohol use, which we call AUA, it's a spectrum ranging from at-risk drinking to full alcohol use disorder. And screening can be completed with the single alcohol screen question, the SASQ. And the question here that we start with is, how many times in the past year have you had 4 or 5, depending on, again, 4 being for women and then 5 being for men, but 4 or 5 or more alcoholic drinks in a day? And a positive score on this test is anything more than 0. Now, if you have someone who screens positive on this question, that's a positive screen and warrants further workup, which we're going to talk about, including further screening. Now, people with unhealthy alcohol use who do not meet criteria for alcohol use disorder should be advised to reduce drinking. I know it's not a surprise to anyone, but also that brief interventions, like literally us talking with our patients, very, very briefly in clinic, can reduce alcohol use. So this is another situation where we can make a difference just with our questions. We're going to talk very briefly about the unhealthy alcohol use assessment tool. And this is something that if you've rotated through a Virginia Mason clinic, or if you have your continuity clinic at one of the Virginia Mason clinics, you will see with literally all of your annuals. And also there are 3 FDA-approved drugs that can decrease alcohol use or prevent a return to drinking. Those are naltrexone, acamprosate, and disulfiram. And I think probably the strongest take-home point here is we should be using them more because they are underutilized.
Very well said. All right, so let's get into some cases. So your first patient is Miss G, an 58-year-old woman who is an accountant and has 3 kids. She has hypertension, obesity, and fatty liver disease. She endorses more stress since her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, with increased fatigue and difficulty sleeping recently. When asked, she states that she normally has 2 to 3 glasses of wine per evening to relax, And occasionally will split a few bottles with friends on the weekends. No tobacco or illicit drug use, and she has never had family or employment issues related to drinking. So, who should be screened for unhealthy alcohol use, and how should we do so?
That's a really good question, and I suspect we will be coming back to this case to talk about her in more detail. I think I already stressed this point, but I'm going to go into a little more detail. But unhealthy alcohol use is the third leading cause of preventable death in the United States after smoking and obesity. And the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends that providers screen all adults over the age of 18 for unhealthy alcohol use. Again, I said all adults. Consider additional screening at high-risk times, like when we're prescribing medications that have an adverse interaction with alcohol, which, by the way, is like basically everything. Pregnancy, after possible alcohol-related injuries, so like those ER visits where they had a fall or a motor vehicle collision. When we are treating chronic pain, because again, that's a wonderful example of a condition that can worsen alcohol use disorder. And of course, the medications often interact badly with alcohol, or of course, obviously in the setting of other substance use. Now, there are many, many validated screening tools for unhealthy alcohol use. And in Virginia Mason Primary Care Clinics, all new patients and patients presenting for their preventative visits are screened with the single alcohol screening questionnaire, which I mentioned earlier, which has pretty good sensitivity and specificity, 82 and 79% for identifying unhealthy alcohol use. And what should be happening is this form is being given to patients by the front desk or the rooming medical assistant. Now, a positive screen, which is again a reminder, anything other than zero, is followed by a more detailed alcohol history gathering, which we use the audit form at Virginia Mason Primary Care Clinics, which is literally on the backside of the screening question form. And I would really encourage all of our listeners, if they haven't looked at that form, because they probably have seen the patient like having it in the room, please do look at both the front and the back. I also just want to call out, the reason that this is done in all Virginia Mason clinics is due to a quality improvement project that was done by some of our former chief residents, one of whom is in primary care, Dr. Amy Thompson. So a really nice example of the work that our residents do to help improve the care of our patients.
All right, next question. What are safe drinking levels? And what are the definitions for levels of alcohol use?
Ooh, Dr. Mohan. Okay, so you asked. So the 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which is authored by the USDA and HHS, advise limiting alcohol intake to 2 drinks a day for men and 1 drink a day for women in order to reduce the risk of alcohol-related harms. People who are 65 or above should limit alcohol intake to 3 drinks per day and no more than 7 drinks per week, while men under the age of 65 should limit it to no more than 4 drinks per day and 14 per week. And drinking in excess of these limits constitutes at risk for heavy alcohol use. So with that said, there is a growing body of evidence that there's really no safe level for alcohol use. And prior observational studies suggest that the health benefits from alcohol really have a lot of confounding issues. So the Global Burden of Disease study in 2016 found that lower alcohol consumption resulted in lower risk for most health outcomes that are associated with alcohol intake, and that the overall risk for disease increased linearly with the number of standard drinks consumed. So basically, probably no amount is safe, and that the more that is consumed, the greater the risk. Now, drinking can lead to adverse health consequences, which is mentioned above, and earlier it can be chronic liver disease, psychological and physiological dependence, but also heart disease, neurologic disease, behavioral health disease. There's also hematologic diseases, like the list goes on and on and on. Also, as we see in the case that you gave us with Miss G, heavier drinking can cause things like hypertension, can worsen metabolic-associated liver disease, can worsen anxiety and insomnia. Many women are also unaware of the link between alcohol consumption and breast cancer. Compared to women who do not drink, women who have 3 alcoholic drinks each week have a 15% higher risk of developing breast cancer. That's a lot. The World Health Organization estimates that 2 million causes of breast cancer globally. Of the 2 million, nearly 100,000 are attributable to alcohol consumption. Now, there are numerous terms that are used to define levels of alcohol use and misuse. So I'm going to go through some definitions, and I'm trying not to put everybody to sleep, but unhealthy alcohol use is like your umbrella term. It's like it's referring to the full spectrum that goes from unhealthy drinking, which includes risky or hazardous drinking, harmful drinking, alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence, terms that we used to use like alcoholism, alcohol addiction, and alcohol use disorder. Now, kind of one end, risky use, a term that I just used, is consumption that puts individuals at risk for health consequences. Again, exceeding the limits that we mentioned earlier. Then there is binge drinking, which is drinking enough alcohol to bring the blood alcohol level to 0.08% or above, which usually for men is drinking 5 drinks or women drinking 4 drinks in about 2 hours. Although again, this varies significantly and can be achieved with even less, depending on the person's body size and other factors. Then we have the term alcohol use disorder, which is this is when drinking leads to impairment or distress. And the DSM-5 outlines 11 psychosocial criteria, which I'm not going to dive into, but they really are all tied to either cravings or having loss of control or having bad consequences from that alcohol use. Now, for those who, and I would recommend all of us, be familiar with the DSM criteria, it's included in the reader. So I direct everybody to go there, but I won't list all 11.
All right. And I think one of the other helpful tips that was in the reader is that we do have dot phrases that will pull them up for you as well, because essentially being able to categorize severity of their alcohol use disorder is how many of the criteria they're meeting. But otherwise, I would say an excellent review of all the reasons why alcohol is just not very good for you. All right. How common is unhealthy drinking in the United States?
Well, I think I've reviewed this a little bit, but unhealthy drinking is very common in the United States. We have a lot of data, but unhealthy alcohol use affects almost a third of adults in the United States. A third. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's not a small amount. I will definitely say that I also ran into it a lot more with the pandemic and still seeing the after effects of that.
Mm-hmm. I am not surprised. I have as well. It turns out the pandemic was not good for us in a lot of different ways.
Very true. All right. So coming back to the case, as you were hoping, you discuss with Miss G that she is drinking more than is safe. She insists that she does not feel any harmful effects of her drinking. In fact, it helps her relax and fall asleep. And when she's relaxed, she feels more productive and happier. She denies craving or withdrawal symptoms when she doesn't drink for a few days. She scores a 7 on the audit. So 4 for drinking more than 4 days per week, 1 for her quantity, and 2 for drinking more than 5 drinks per day on a monthly basis. So what now? How can you help her recognize the potential harm in her drinking habits?
This is a really good question, and there are a couple of different approaches we could take. I'm going to start with, she doesn't meet criteria for alcohol use disorder, but she is definitely at risk. And we have good evidence that a brief intervention here has a very reasonable chance statistically to make a difference in her future health. And when a healthcare professional engages a patient who is showing risky substance abuse with a short conversation, a couple of different approaches you can use, but again, this can have a real benefit. So a good format is to start with always asking permission. So, and we want to ask in a non-judgmental way, but ask, is it okay if I talk to you about that alcohol use and that form that you filled out? The next step is to assess for the patient's readiness for change. And ideally, we want to ask the patient to articulate on a scale of 1 to 10, because remember, this is part of our motivational interviewing, from 1 to 10, with 10 being the highest level, how ready they are to make a change. And again, we're asking this in a non-judgmental way. Finally, when they give us a number, we ask the patient why they didn't choose a lower number. So they have some degree of readiness, and we can ask, well, why don't you have even less readiness? Because then they will be articulating what they see right now and the downsides to that behavior. So this is a very, very quick and easy thing that literally takes a minute, if not less. Now, after a brief intervention, which again, this is just starting motivational interviewing, if the patient's not ready for change, first of all, that's okay. But we've started the process, and self-reflection is encouraged, and indeed we are triggering that with the question. And we want to stress that we are happy to discuss it again in the future if they would like, and happy to provide assistance. And if the patient does indicate motivation to change, wonderful! Because our next step then is we're going to help the patient make specific goals for change, like reduction in drinking, or offering additional resources, and things like pharmacotherapy, and of course, follow-up. Now, of note, brief interventions are more effective for at-risk drinkers than patients who qualify for like full-blown alcohol use disorder. So again, earlier that we do this, the better. And in a landmark randomized controlled trial of brief interventions for at-risk drinkers in the primary care setting, drinking was reduced by 38 grams a week on average, and there's a 12% reduction in at-risk drinking in the population. And this is just phenomenal because this is like a one-minute intervention that has no side effects and doesn't cost anything. So that's pretty amazing.
And that's like a number needed to treat of like 10, 7, 8.
So for those who can't see, sorry, I was doing poor math in my head and Dr. Mohan was trying to follow that. But yes, somewhere between 8 and 10.
I guess the answer to that is actually 9.
Thank you for the snark, Dr. Mohan.
All right, so back to the case. She agrees to discuss alcohol further after you advise that alcohol likely contributes to her hypertension, fatty liver, and insomnia. She states she's a 3 on the readiness to change scale of 0 to 10. When asked why not lower, she says that in addition to the health consequences, she worries about the impact alcohol can have on her relationships with her family. She agrees to cut her drinking back to 1 to 2 drinks per evening and will try to limit herself to 10 per week. After affirming her self-efficacy, you ask if she is willing to schedule a follow-up visit, and she agrees. At the 6-week follow-up, she reports that she has successfully cut back to 10 drinks a week and thanks you for your support. Nice job.
That's fantastic. That's really, really great.
All right. Now let's make it a little harder. So next case, you next see Mr. H, a 54-year-old man who previously worked as a banker and is now unemployed. He has a strong family history of substance use disorders. He started drinking at age 14, engaged in binge drinking in college, and drank socially and at business meetings in his 20s to 30s. He was recently divorced and is estranged from his children as a result of heavy drinking. He currently endorses a 9 out of the 11 DSM-5 criteria when you ask him further. Although he was in the pre-contemplative state for years, he has been actively trying to stop drinking in the past year and wants your help. He's had multiple hospital admissions for elective detoxification, sometimes followed by inpatient rehab programs or intensive outpatient programs. He goes to AA 3 times a week and finds it somewhat helpful. He had a 4-month period of sobriety earlier in the year. Unfortunately, whenever he is not hired after an interview or has a fight with his ex, he turns back to alcohol. He currently is drinking 1 pint of vodka a day and plans to enroll in an intensive outpatient program after elective detoxification. He asks what other help you can provide for a more successful attempt at cessation. So my first question is, what other medical and psychiatric comorbidities should you assess for? And what may be contributing to Mr. H's difficulty with long-term abstinence?
Ooh, well, this is a really challenging case. So thank you. So I'd start with saying it's important to review the physiologic consequences that our patient has sustained from his alcohol use. So we want to think about looking for those organ involvements. So things like the stigmata of liver disease, also things like on the cardiovascular side, like hypertension, cardiomyopathy, AFib, of course, looking for very obvious jaundice, but also asking about things like gastritis, looking again for those signs of ascites and hepatosplenomegaly and spiders, telangiectasias. Also, of course, assessing for any chronic history of pancreatitis, and then hematologic disorders like myelosuppression. And then we have our neurologic complications like neuropathy and Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. And then on the endocrine side, hypogonadism and metabolic derangements, including like hypomagnesemia and hypokalemia. Now, we're not done with the things we need to look for. We also need to think about the kind of comorbid behavioral health and psychiatric disorders that could be resulting from or driving this process, like depression, which would not be surprising. In fact, he's screaming depression, anxiety, psychosis, bipolar disorder, PTSD, and antisocial personality disorder. And of course, we also want to screen for intimate partner violence and also think about other coexisting substance use disorders. And all of this can ultimately lead, in the way we want to frame it, as we're trying to help identify triggers for their drinking and developing ways to help avoid them, asking why he drinks, what he enjoys about drinking, and most importantly, reasons why he may drink when not intending to, and then what are the downsides to it that he sees. Now, a helpful reminder. We in primary care tend to love SSRIs. They are useful for a lot of different conditions that we treat. They are not effective for treating alcohol use disorder, but are helpful adjuncts, particularly for treating those comorbid behavioral health conditions like depression or anxiety. And in his case, one of the triggers might be depression or anxiety regarding his ongoing challenges with social health and his employment status. And his coping skills may be lacking or very stressed, which are components discussed in substance abuse counseling programs. So, kind of our take-homes here that I want our leaders to get. Remember to reinforce with patients that alcohol use disorder is a medical condition, and it is not a lack of willpower, and that there are things that we can do to help and other things that he can do to help.
I think that last statement is really important to make sure that your patients understand, and I think it really helps in kind of keeping yourself as like their ally and someone who is supporting them and not judging them about having to deal with this disorder. So the next question is, what are the treatment options for alcohol use disorder?
Ooh, so there are a lot of different treatment options. So one of them is the one that we've already discussed, repeated behavioral interventions by us, their PCP. Other options, there are self-monitoring, like there are smartphone apps, and they can keep diaries, again, where they are gathering that information and looking at it, and that is the intervention. Then there is counseling. There are a lot of different kinds of counseling, including cognitive behavioral therapy. Then there are motivational enhancement therapies. can be usually done with a counselor, but can also be done through other tools like smartphone apps. There is couples counseling for couples who are drinking together, or if that's one of the main triggers. Then there are mutual help programs like Alcoholic Anonymous, AA, and SMART. And then there are like specialty treatments like inpatient or outpatient intensive treatment programs. And finally, there are medications. Now, Dr. Mohan, you may be wondering, which one is the best of those? Because I just went through a long list. And when we look at meta-analyses comparing things like CBT and motivational enhancement therapy and 12-step programs like AA, basically we found low to moderate level efficacy for all these programs. The meta-analyses that we have not found strong evidence to support one modality over another. And I think that's a really key point that usually leads me when I'm working with patients to say, what's going to work best for you? And it might be some trial and error, and that's okay. Now, if we specifically look at AA, because it is a very well-known program, there is a very widespread coverage across the country, data on its efficacy is conflicting. I will just say, though, AA has the benefit of being high impact potentially. It is free, and it is widely accessible, not just in the United States, but over large stretches of the world, and really only requires that someone is at a point where they desire to stop drinking. There is a website, aa.org. You can pull it up in the room. There are a lot of different meetings, and basically there are meetings for everyone. Like, there is no socioeconomic strata or general personality type where there are not likely to be meetings where someone will feel like they can fit in. So it's important to screen patients who are interested in alcohol cessation, and also thinking about those who are going to be at risk for alcohol withdrawal. And there are different tools for this. The tool that we include in the reader is the Prediction of Alcohol Withdrawal Severity Scale, PAWIS, and it's just a way of getting at, have they had symptoms of withdrawal before? Because those who are likely to have withdrawal and might have DTs, you're going to frame all this conversation from a point of, we might need to do an inpatient detoxification first before we do the longer-term outpatient management.
All right. So you talk to Mr. H about all of these options. He is interested in taking medication to help prevent relapse after his upcoming outpatient detox program. So what are the options?
Hooray! So our medications, as I mentioned earlier, are probably underutilized, and we have three different options that are at least FDA approved, and there are a couple that are not FDA approved. But these medications do not require any specialized addiction medicine training, so all of us are capable of doing it. And we probably prescribe some of these medicines for other things. And they are not controlled, one kind of pseudo exception, nor do they generally have any dependency potential themselves. So three are naltrexone, acamprosate, and disulfiram. And then some off-label ones that are used include gabapentin, topiramate, and baclofen. As we know, gabapentin is kind of the one as far as some requirements and controlled status. So the three that are FDA approved have been studied in moderate to severe alcohol use disorder. And so let's first talk about naltrexone. And this is used at a higher dose, like 50 milligrams a day. And you can up titrate to 100 milligrams daily after a week. And really, we're looking here at targeting the cravings because it's disrupting that reward pathway in the brain. Now, definitely naltrexone can have side effects, particularly the GI ones with nausea, but also people can get some fatigue. Often the nausea gradually improves after a couple weeks. And there's a very rare side effect of hepatotoxicity, which is why we monitor liver function testing. And basically, if it goes up more than 3 to 5 times with your transaminases, you need to pull the drug. Now, it is obviously contraindicated to use naltrexone if they are on chronic opiate therapy or if you're anticipating that you will need to be using opiates while they would be on the naltrexone, because obviously the naltrexone can precipitate a withdrawal. And I also want to call out, there is a depot formulation, an intramuscular injection form of naltrexone. It's only available under the brand name Vivitrol. This is an absurdly expensive drug, upwards of $3,000 a month. I've been successfully able to get coverage in other substance uses occasionally, but it is very challenging to get insurance coverage, and it's highly variable. And this is a medication that has to be given in the clinic, so your staff has to be able to administer it and give it. And so they have to come in every month to get it. But it can be a very good option because, again, it's relatively easy to get good adherence if you only have to give a dose once a month. Now, next medication, acamprosate, and this is 666 milligrams 3 times a day. Now, 3 times a day, that's an annoying amount, and that's the part I like least about it. But one of its nice things is it is safe in liver disease. Again, you can use it even in cirrhosis. And it works best if you start it pretty early on, like a few days after they are abstinent of alcohol use. And it has GI side effects too. There's a common theme here with diarrhea, but it can also cause some increased anxiousness and depressed mood symptoms, which is generally not helpful. But that's the thing you want to think about with acamprosate. Now, the third FDA-approved drug is disulfiram, which is probably the least useful of these three. It's 250 milligrams once a day, And again, it has probably the poorest efficacy. But as a reminder, this is going back to medical school, what this does is it disrupts the alcohol metabolism in the body and disrupts alcohol dehydrogenase, and you will get literally what is called a disulfiram-like reaction, where people will get sick if they have disulfiram in their system and they drink alcohol, and they will feel pretty miserable. So it kind of compels, if you've taken the medication and you then drink, you will be very, very, very regretful of it. Which leads to often why this doesn't work is people simply just don't take it. And that's kind of its main downside. And it can cause a peripheral neuropathy. I have never seen that in the patients I have prescribed it, but it is a possible risk. Now, I want to make special note of another medication that I mentioned earlier that would be off-label use, which is topiramate. And so topiramate, we started a low dose, again, 25 milligrams, and we gradually up-titrate every week to 300 milligrams. And the nice thing about topiramate is it can help reduce cravings. It also can be helpful with obesity management, and it has that nice migraine prevention effect, and it's also an anti-seizure drug. So it has a lot of nice other benefits to it, but it can cause the cognitive brain fog and, of course, very strongly contraindicated in pregnancy. And it can also increase your risk of kidney stones. But anyways, that is another very appropriate medication that you'd be using off-label. Now, Dr. Boucher has included a wonderful table in the reader that walks through all of this if you weren't able to keep up with all those points that I just made. Also, SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, publishes a free resource that is targeted towards us to help us be comfortable with these medications. And we've included the link in the reader. So those are some of the different treatment options.
All right. Well, to conclude the case, you have this great discussion, and with some shared patient decision-making, Mr. H chooses naltrexone because of ease of use. After 1 month, he found the oral pills helpful, but would return to drinking if he missed doses. So after switching to the monthly IM doses, he has remained abstinent from alcohol for 6 months, which is great. He no longer craves a drink when faced with stressful situations and speaks to others battling with this disease about strategies for success. Given his underlying depression, he is enrolled in a dual diagnosis intensive outpatient program and is taking sertraline, which has been very helpful for him.
That's wonderful. This is a really positive update. I also want to direct all the listeners to the reader once again, because Dr. Boucher and Dr. Warner had included a long list of different resources, including websites with links to like the Seattle AA page, as well as other educational resources. Again, a lot of nice websites that are worth favoriting. So those are the points I wanted to review today. Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Mohan.
Thank you so much for covering such an important topic and giving us, I think, a very nice, clear outline of, you know, how to approach this in clinic, have those really important conversations, and then just feel that we have a lot of tools at our disposal to best help our patients as they're trying to navigate, you know, what really is a lifelong disease once it's developed.
Well, thank you.
All right, everyone, have a good day, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.